Why do many people work so hard? Dear Lily, people usually prefer leisure to labour. Even if they say they like work, it's often preferable to watch others doing it or to contemplate doing it sometime in the future. Jerome K. Jerome joked, "I like work. It fascinates me. I can sit and look at it for hours." So most people have to be compelled to work, especially if, as is usually the case, it is boring and physical. How are people forced to work? One method is the system of free, in inverted commas, market relations, labour for wages, which is the one you are familiar with. A second form is serfdom. Serfs have to do certain labour services for their lord and pay animals as a form of rent. They cannot sell their or alienate their holdings without their lord's agreement in the manorial court. They are under pressure to have their grain ground in the lord's mill. They have to consult with their neighbours about what crops they will grow. They cannot enclose their strips of land without permission. Often they have to pay a tax if they marry off their children. Sometimes they are not allowed to move from their holding without the lord's consent. On the other hand, they are not slaves. They should not be physically abused by their lord. They cannot be bought and sold. They can own personal property. In other words, they are not things, but active and right-bearing human beings, though tied down to a particular place and occupation. Such serfdom existed in England until the 15th century, when its last remnants mysteriously vanished. In Eastern Europe, it remained the major form of labour condition until the 19th century. Then there is a widespread form of organisation that often overlaps with, but is different from, serfdom. This is family-based or household production. Its central feature is that the compulsion to work is exerted neither through the market wages mechanism, nor through direct lordly power, serfdom. It comes at one remove from the lord through the compulsion of the family. There is often an enormous pressure towards hard work, but this comes to bear on the individual through loyalty to the family line. There is also a desperate need to extract a living and pay rents to the lord. This is the characteristic form in much of Africa, India, China, and South America, as well as many Mediterranean countries. A final form is slavery, which is characteristic of ancient civilizations. Here, people are bought and sold as goods. They are the property of others and have no rights. The technologies of metals, writing, weaving, and ploughing led for centuries to the use of slaves. Rome was the last great civilization in the West to be based on slavery, the end of an era lasting over 3,000 years. There were periods of revival, such as that in the Caribbean and in the southern states of America. But the system has been dying out. Although there are still many slaves in parts of North Africa, South and Central America and elsewhere, slavery is not the ways that working is basically organized nowadays. Both slavery and the family farming system make people unwilling to use animals or machines. It is almost always cheaper, inverted commas, to work all hours than to keep capital invested in animals, mills and other machinery. These systems, which covered much of East Asia and India, and to a large extent Mediterranean Europe, tend to drive out labor-saving technologies. Slavery and family labor make human labor a priority. Only a free market system, and sometimes serfdom, make it highly desirable to replace humans by machines. How did we get to our world? If you had looked at the world in around 1750, you would have seen that much of it seemed to have reached a plateau where it could not get any richer. Indeed, much of it was already getting poorer. With the technologies then known, it was impossible to improve the general position of mankind. Nor could the earth feed many more than the 500 million, half a billion, then living on this planet. There were, however, two exceptions. One was North America, which was experiencing the fastest economic growth in the world. Its population was tiny and the resources vast. This looked as if it would be a temporary phenomenon once again, for the country would quite soon use up its immense resources of soil and timber. There would be a burst of growth, as there had been in China, India, and the Mediterranean. And in a century or two, America would arrive at the same plateau. The other exception was England. It had started at a low level, a trading nation sucking in materials from elsewhere. The country had an odd social structure. There was no large, poverty-stricken rural group, but rather a large and prosperous, increasingly urban and urbanized culture. It had a highly efficient farming system. For centuries it had grown gradually richer, and it was continuing to do so. By the 1750s it was, per head, and in terms of energy available per person, the wealthiest and technologically most sophisticated country on earth. Yet, in 1750, it seemed inevitable that even England, in due course, would hit the invisible buffers. The conversion of energy from the sun using plants and animals will yield only a certain amount for humans. Another century of growth at the most, and then England, like America, would end on a high level but flat path. Another civilization that could not move in a new direction. England's special state was plainly visible. People noticed the improving technologies of production and the interest in wealth creation and scientific discovery. They even noted the increasing use of fossil fuels and the growth of wealth flowing in from the British Empire. Yet no one at that stage could see the impending revolutionary change. For the English had harnessed the power of steam. Who could have foreseen that the long path of replacing human labour by animals, wind, water, and increasingly coal, and doing this through sophisticated machines, especially mills, would suddenly transform the whole world? Who could have known that what was at first merely a change in scale, a movement along a pre-existing path, almost a natural evolution, would suddenly alter everything and become a revolution? What did the steam engine do? The steam engine was only a small adjustment to a device that had been known to the Romans and the Chinese for thousands of years. Hitherto, it had had no significance whatsoever. Now the fact that humans could convert coal into energy by way of fire and steam was to alter life on Earth. The human species, having to live off supplies of energy from the sun, a current account whereby the sun's energy was converted to human use through living creatures, was beginning to change. Instead, humans began to draw on an immense deposit account, the energy locked up over millions of years in fossil fuels. Of course, living off stored energy was not entirely new. Humans had often done this by using the stocks of fish, timber, and rich land on new frontiers. Yet in the past, they had quickly burned up much of this surface stored energy. What the steam engine did was to sit at the top of a funnel which went down into the vast reserves of highly concentrated sunlight that had fallen on the Earth over millions of years. The stored energy in the fallen timber had become coal. Later, the process was repeated with oil, and then with gas. In each case, the thin trickle of energy available to each person from the sun became a gushing torrent, a world not only of vast energy resources, but also of many other side products in alloys, pesticides, and plastics opened up. We could not have predicted any of this in the middle of the 18th century. Even as late as the middle of the 19th century, many intelligent people could still not appreciate what had happened and its implications. The economic laws that had limited humankind for thousands of years had been temporarily suspended. This new technology could be exported, but it was not an easy or obvious change. Even after the first model of how the industrial system based on steam had been revealed. It took almost 80 years for this success to be repeated anywhere else, in Germany, Japan, and North America. The huge momentum of China and India was leading them in other directions. And it was over 150 years after the start of the British Industrial Revolution that a similar change began to happen in those great civilizations. For the move towards industrialization is not easy, even when there are successful models to follow and much of the technology can be bought off the shelf. What are the possible paths through time? It's clear that these various pressures constitute a series of paths. A society or civilization starts off with new potentials. It has fresh, unused soil and forests, a good stock of animals, and knowledge of the technologies of the wheel, fire, and simple mills to use water power. Its social structure is fairly firm and just. Yet over time, the normal tendency is not towards bettering the lot of the majority or finding new ways to get nature to yield up its goods. The flocks and herds do not increase. The coal seams are hardly exploited. The wind and waters are not increasingly harnessed. The agricultural tools are not decisively improved. A shortage of working capital leads people to borrow against their future harvests at a very high rate of interest. The power of lenders increases, and the ordinary villagers become debt-ridden and increasingly impoverished. We might have expected human labour to be supplemented, and hence human material life to be improved. Yet the desire of the powerful to become more powerful, a growing population's pressing on resources, and the fear of shortages constrain people and force them in a direction that is, in the long run, harmful to them and their descendants. This leads them away from the one possibility of an escape from agrarian labour. Unless we understand these powerful paths, which lie beyond the long-term development of civilizations and become self-reinforcing, we cannot understand how what has happened in the world has happened. We have to understand that the great civilizations of India, China, Japan, and much of continental Europe were heading towards or had already reached a high-level path that could not lead towards industrialization. They were, if anything, moving away from an industrial solution. Why do humans often give up using animals? Domesticated animals are the earliest and most effective machines, in inverted commas, available to humans. They take the strain off the human back and arms. Used with other techniques, animals can raise human living standards very considerably, both as supplementary foodstuffs protein in meat and milk, and as machines to carry burdens, ploughs, lift water, grind grain. Since they are so obviously of great benefit, we might expect to find that over the centuries, humans would increase the number and quality of the animals they kept. Surprisingly, this has not usually been the case. In Japan, domesticated animals were quite widely used in the period up to about 1600. There were large numbers of horses and oxen. After that, as the population grew, the animals were gradually replaced by human labour. By the later 19th century, there were practically no large domestic animals in the intensive rice-growing areas of central Japan. All the land was being used to grow crops, so there was nowhere for the animals to be kept. In any case, human labour was cheaper. I saw this same process happening over a very short period of just a couple of generations in a Nepalese hill village. In the middle of the 19th century, of the 20th century, there were large numbers of buffaloes, cows, sheep, goats, oxen, and other livestock, providing milk, meat, and manure, and working as plough animals. By the end of the century, three quarters of the animals had disappeared. People could not afford, in inverted commas, to keep them. It was cheaper to hire a man to carry goods up to the village, a five-hour walk up a steep mountain, than to keep or hire a mule. It was not only in Asia that this was happening. It's possible to see the same pattern over many parts of Western Europe. For instance, in France, the animal energy available per head in terms of oxen, horses, sheep, and goats was higher in the 13th century than in the 18th. It seems a law of nature that animals are replaced by humans, and that people have to turn from a protein-rich to a carbohydrate diet. Animals are in many ways a luxury. Only the relatively well-off can afford them. Poverty edges them out. A son will replace a donkey or ox carrying goods on his back, or dig with a hoe or spade rather than a plough with an animal. Domesticated animals have no collective bargaining power. Why does more often lead to less? Animals are just one example. The use of wind, water, wheels, and gunpowder, rather than increasing as civilizations grew in population and sophistication, tended to decline. Almost everywhere, human labor replaced every other form of power, a form of virtual and sometimes actual slavery was the answer. Sometimes this concentration on human labor was increased by the ecological conditions in a civilization, and particularly by the nature of the staple crop. Some crops, such as wheat, encourage the use of animals in ploughing and of mills in grinding. Others, like rice, encourage the use of humans in planting, weeding, cutting, threshing, and husking. Rice also has the special ability to increase the population size, since the usual law by which, after a certain point, extra work brings less and less reward, is slow to act. Extra children improve the output of rice for a considerable time. Furthermore, much of the fertilizing of rice plants is done by natural processes in the water, so that less animal manure is needed. The decline of domesticated animals has a less harmful effect than it does with wheat, maize, and barley. Growing wet rice encourages hard work rather than the move towards non-human power, that is to say, industrialization. Rice is such a fruitful grain that it tempts people down a dangerous path away from progress. Temptation also comes from other plants, such as bamboo, which is so wonderfully versatile that it inhibits the use of other woods and metals. Likewise, the paper mulberry tree saved much of Asia from having to develop the much more difficult rag-based paper of the West. Yet it was the effort of pounding the rags that helped the development of machinery and water power. So there was a vast difference between a bamboo and paper civilization, such as China and Japan, and a wood and stone civilization, such as Western Europe. In Asia, nature provided the raw materials, which merely had to be shaped. In the West, nature was stingier, and more effort had to be put into making the substitutes in glass and iron and stone. Yet the extra effort and increased knowledge paid off in the longer term. For most of history, the Asian solution was far more effective in bringing a reasonable standard of living to many millions of people. In the end, however, it was the path through coal, iron, and steam that led to our modern world of industry. That many of us no longer have to labour for long hours in the fields is a merciful release and a giant accident. The changes that occurred on one small island in the 18th century constituted the second great productive revolution in human history, equal in impact to the domestication of animals and plants. It is very recent, and it still alleviates the stress of hard physical work only for fewer than half of those who live on this planet.